But before I begin, I'd like to just give a couple of acknowledgements for some of the material that I have. I've found personally great profit from the material that is readily available from the Australian Christian Lobby. Martin Isles and his work is quite remarkable, I think, here in Australia at the moment. I've also would like to especially acknowledge the work of Dr. Peter Jones. He heads up an online ministry called Truth Exchange. He's written a great many books and speaks all around the world in a constant rotation, pretty much all the Western countries. And his speeches are online and can be easily viewed on YouTube. I have found his work to be especially helpful. It's challenged me to rethink and refocus. He is quite a remarkable man. He's devoted his life as a scholar with his various degrees to understanding and engaging sensibly with the new paganism of our age. Dr. Peter Jones, The Truth Exchange. So, our subject, or my subject this evening, is refocusing for ministry to pagans. The first thing I'd like to consider with you is this question. Is there need for the church to refocus for ministry to pagans? Well, it's my belief that there is indeed such a need. Why? Well, because there has been a generational shift in Australia from a Christian worldview to what can be called a neo-pagan framework of thought. In the generation of our fathers, my father, and his lifetime has seen this shift. Now, in this speech, when I use the term pagan or paganism, I'd like you to understand what's meant. So let me give you a definition. It means that worldview and spirit that spiritually fills the void when a human being denies the one true God and Creator. The creator-creature distinction is denied so that for that person, everything is one, one is all, and all is or contains the divine, including, of course, ourselves. If we want contact with the divine, we have to look within. Now, Peter Jones, in his book, The Other Worldview, exposing Christianity's greatest threat, he explains it a bit further. And he says, those who call themselves pagans or neo-pagans deliberately worship the earth or themselves as aspects of the divine and do not accept Christian orthodoxy's claims regarding the uniquely self-existent God of creation and salvation. Indeed, pagans are usually conscientiously opposed to organized religion in any form. There is an almost limitless variety of expressions of paganism, but pagan religions are all ultimately oneist. That is, they deny the distinction between the creator and the creation. The creation is all. So that's what we mean by paganism. That's what we are going to be focusing in on as it rises in Australia. Now, the rise of paganism in our day is not just another thing that's happening among many other things. It is, I believe, the unifying, underlying principle that explains what's happening in our country. And for that reason, I believe we need to get our heads around it. Peter Jones again explains this. He says, over the last two generations, I've watched the oneism of ancient paganism overtake the centuries-old Western cultural structures rooted in basic notions of biblical truth. In other words, biblical Christianity. The lie of oneism is on the rise, in large part because it is now being presented as an articulate cosmology. Now, kids, young people, if you're here, what cosmology means is a cohesive way of understanding everything. So let me just read it again. The lie of oneism is on the rise in part because it is now being presented as an articulate way of understanding everything. It's capable of explaining the whole of human existence, and it's claiming to define the right side of history, and it's demanding to be culturally normative so it controls everything. This attempt to dismantle the Christian worldview's belief in a divinely created universe of structure and order, now listen to this, not only undermines right knowledge of and worship of the Creator, but it severely hinders people from hearing and understanding the Christian truest gospel at all. Now that's significant. And that's the point, I think, that where we are at this conference. That's the point of interest for us. Something has changed. And that change has the power to hinder Australians from hearing and understanding the gospel at all. Now, that's got to be of great importance to us and to the church and its ministry. So is Peter Jones correct? What if Australians are now embracing a largely pagan world and life view? But the church continues to view and address those Australians as if they retained the truths of Scripture in their mind. What happens then? Well, I'm going to leave out a big chunk in my speech here because I'm not going to have time. Well, we don't want to continue to address Australians as if they're Christians. That would be to aim the message at the place where people used to be. We have to grapple with the fact that modern pagans do not think like us Christians. They don't even think like people who used to be Christians. They think like modern day pagans. They live, from their viewpoint, in a different world. They see it differently, sometimes completely different informs their life, their religion, their ethics, their sexuality, and the goals and aspirations of their lives. They live in a different world to what you live in as a Christian. They're not like the old God is dead atheists. These people are deeply spiritual, and they do have ethics, but they are nothing like your spirituality or ethics as a Christian. So, I'm going to show how that's the case in a few moments. But it's my conviction that Australian society has only a portion of its Christian minority still outside of this new paganism. In other words, a lot of the Christian church has already at least got its nose or half of its body inside the new paganism. And the average Australian lives in a fundamentally pagan world. The average church member and our covenant children are growing up in this new age and are in a very real spiritual crisis. And ignorance is not bliss. And to not know is not to be safe. That's extraordinarily dangerous. If you were to imagine a cloth, a long cloth, and you roll it up on a tube like you might get from a shop, and it's rolled ever so tightly. And you take that rolled cloth and you tie string around it and you close the ends off, and then you dip it into ink. and you leave it there. And then you pull it out and you unroll it. You will find that it's impregnated. It's the impress of that ink has gone not just to the surface layer, but it's gone down deeper. And as you unroll it, you'll come to a clean bit in the middle. The Christian church is holy. But you dip it into the paganism of the world today and it will be affected. It will be affected. And we are affected. Except we don't realise it. We don't recognise all the ways in which this permeates into our lives. So, it's not possible not to be tainted. We can't put walls up. We can't go into a monastery. The church is God's light in the world. It must engage with that culture and bring the gospel to it. So this is a major challenge for us. Antithetical holiness that receives the whole of a sanctified life from the hand of Jesus Christ is in retreat in the Presbyterian Reformed churches. The big question for us is increasingly becoming, what minimum thing is needed to squeak into heaven? Let me say it again to you. Antithetical holiness that receives the whole of a sanctified life from the hand of Jesus Christ is in retreat in our lives, in our homes, and in our church. There is a shift in attitude and ethics. It's there all around us, and it does affect us. Hence the implied plea in this speech for us to refocus and even to retool our ministry in such a way that we do address this new situation with understanding and clarity. Not only for ministry to the unchurched, but also to the churched. So what do we need to understand if we are to refocus? Well, I'd like us to be guided by what Pastor Shand read in Romans chapter 1 for us. That reveals a development of sin in societies. Romans 1 describes really the pattern of that development. You find, first of all, that there is the description of the root of the problem. Let's close this Bible. We need it open again. If you've got a Bible there, please turn to Romans chapter 1 so you can follow along. If you haven't got one, do by all means feel free to grab one quickly. The root of the problem that we face is undoubtedly the fall of mankind in Adam, its covenant head. Adam, as we know, refused to recognise God's right to lay down the terms for life. The terms for life in the garden. And Adam's disobedience was radical. He was grasping, and we in him, for life upon our own terms. For life in denial of God. For life in denial of God's right to rule over us. And that was, in principle, as Satan promised, a becoming like God and knowing good and evil, determining for ourselves what will be right and wrong, and how we will indeed structure our life without God in the picture. Now, mankind in his rebellion principally denies the creator and creature distinction and everything that it entails. And so Peter Jones describes this fall into sin and the inevitable slide into full-blown paganism. He describes this entering in as the quintessential primordial sin that is the paradigm for all the rest. Now I think that's right. That's exactly right. And then within that paradigm of denial of God and the rejection of the Creator and the looking then with all your focus to the material universe and yourself, within that paradigm, there's a development. And that's what Romans 1 is describing. In principle, what's happened when Adam and Eve transgressed the creature-creator distinction, that had become, in the Apostle Paul's time, a flood of paganism. Pagan religions that suppressed this truth and turned nature into God. The rebellion of Adam and Eve is the seedling that comes to mature fruition in the fully fledged systems of God denying paganism. And that's what Romans is describing. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into the image made like to corruptible man, to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. And in verse 25, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped the creature rather than the Creator. Verse 26, they changed the natural use. There's three changes described there that flow from that first sin and rejection of God. Before we look at those changes and the development of it, how it all arrives at its pagan expression, let's just notice the context for a moment because it's wonderful. First off, in Romans chapter 1, verse 1, you've got the Apostle Paul who says, I have been called to be an apostle and separated unto the gospel of God. Hear that? Separated unto the gospel of God. Right off the bat, first up, right up front, there's the focus. This is God's work. This is God's gospel. And then he shows in the next verses the content of that gospel. It concerns his Son, Jesus Christ, so this God who's created us and is our Savior God is also Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's all implied there. And then that is set in a very real present context. Verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness of men who hold or suppress and hold down, means refuse to acknowledge, the truth in unrighteousness. So that's the setting. The gospel, which he goes on in verse 16 and says he's not ashamed of because it's the power of God. That gospel, which has as its content Jesus Christ, it is revealed against the backdrop, the black backdrop of this awful degradation of man and the wrath of God against it. And then, as you go on in verses 19 through 21, the reasons are given. And these don't only vindicate the justice of God, they show how inexcusable that suppression of the truth really is. There is no excuse in verse 20. In verse 19, because God has shown men what may be known of him. Where? How? When? Well, the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So Paul is establishing here the fact that God, the invisible God, the otherwise completely unknowable God, has revealed himself in his attributes through the mighty work of creation. You know that there's a God. You do. You know there's a divine being who is eternal, who is Almighty, who is invisible. And Paul says, we are completely without excuse to suppress that truth. You might not know him savingly, but you know he exists. You can think of that, of Stephen Hawking, poor, twisted man, thinking through the whole of his cosmology without God, and coming to that point where he has to face the fact that everything came into being out of nothing. And he has to say, well, whatever it was, you would call it God. Mankind feels after God, the invisible God, and is at the same time denying God. And he creates for himself a religious world and life view, and it's called paganism. And so Paul's establishing here not only the existence of God, but also the Creator. And the creature-creator distinction. Now, do you see that? This is big picture stuff, but it's fundamental, and it's what our neighbours don't even anymore understand. There is a God who is in a category all of his own. He's completely invisible. You cannot put him under a microscope. No amount of scientific development will ever take you into his presence so you can see him. But he exists. And he's created everything. His divinity and his eternal power is revealed in creation. And he is one category. And everything else, which we call creation, or the cosmos, or the universe, is another thing. So you've got not one-ism, where there's just us and our in the universe, but two-ism, God and us. And he's first. And that's what Paul's establishing. But when man exchanges that God for the creation, that's when it all comes undone. So there's three exchanges that are described here. And they change in such a way that they deny that two-ism and try and establish a one-ism. Now let me just give you a couple of definitions for those things, or descriptions of them. Now, I think Peter Jones's work in this area is very useful in lots of ways, but especially because of these two terms. Two-ism, one-ism. Everybody understands what you're talking about when you say those words, when you give just a little bit of a meaning to them. So let me just describe what they mean. Two-ism is a world that is the free work of a personal, transcendent God. Two-ism. The God who creates out of nothing. The God who, when he creates, is not constrained by or dependent upon anything pre-existing. Now, there's nothing like that in our human experience. That's unique to God. This worldview celebrates. Now, this is really important. This worldview of two-ism celebrates distinction, difference, otherness. We only worship as divine the distinct personal triune God who placed essential distinctions within his creation. Now, that's what Peter Jones calls heterocosmology. Now, sorry, kids, that's a big word. Sorry, everybody, perhaps that's a big word. The Greek for that is hetero, the same. I'm sorry. Hetero, different. Cosmology, all that is. So there's difference in all that is. So heterocosmology is a worldview based on otherness and difference. Now you say to yourself, well, Pastor, you're not saying anything new. Well, wait a minute. That's completely new and radical to most of the people that you'll talk to in Australia today. So there's this truism, and then in contrast to that, we have what we could call oneism. Now here we're describing what happens when man turns from God to the creation. Now man sees the world as a self-creating or perpetually existing, self-explaining oneness. Everything's made up of the same stuff, whether it's matter or spirit or a mixture of the both. There's only one kind of existence, which in one way or another we worship as divine. It's of ultimate importance, even if that means we're worshipping ourselves. And although there's some apparent differentiation and even greater and lesser that we see around us, in the onest view of the world, in principle, all distinctions are eliminated. Everything has the same worth. Has anybody been listening to the news recently and hearing a little bit about the ethics of Peter Singer that's coming through in the world? I'll get to him in a minute. But that's exactly what's happening. Everything has the same worth. That's homocosmology. A worldview based on everything being the same. And the classic term for that is paganism. The worship of nature. So we've got truism and oneism. And in Romans chapter 1, Paul describes a threefold exchange and what it produces. And here we've got really the process of either developing or returning to paganism. So three exchanges in critical domains are given. First of all, there's theology in verse 23. Change the glory of the uncorruptible God into the image made like corruptible man. A change in the truth. The truth is exchanged now for the lie, and God is replaced by the cosmos. The distinction between the creator and the creature at that point is gone. The creature has been placed in the position of the creator. Now that's fundamental. That's the very essence of paganism. It's what makes it tick. And then you have in verse 25 an exchange in the realm of spirituality and worship. They exchange the truth for the lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. Now it's really important for us to realize that spirituality is not lost. People still worship. And they are fully committed to their worship. Their whole heart and soul is in it. But it's focused now on the wrong object. And we must not imagine or ever say to a pagan, you don't worship. That's true, they don't worship truly. They don't worship the living and true God through Jesus Christ and by the power of the Holy Spirit. That's true. But they do engage with all their heart and soul in the pursuit of, and like Paul says in Acts 17, in feeling after God and never finding him. There is a God-shaped hole like a black vacuum that's sucking in everything that passes them in their life to try and fill the place where God should be. But they worship. And then it follows on to another exchange in the realm of sexuality in verse 26. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, even their women did change the natural usage of that which is against nature. Another sex exchange. Now we'll get to that in a minute, why that's so. Those three aspects of human existence, what you believe concerning God, your spirituality and your worship, and your view of sexuality are linked. And so are the consequences of changing from the truth to the lie in those areas. So man makes his exchange, and God then, as the righteous judge, gives him over to the consequences. That's what you have here in Romans 1. And three givings over are in this passage too. In verse 24, God gives them over to the lust of their own hearts. They turn from him to the creation, and God gives them over to be completely dominated by what I would describe as the pursuit of pleasurable sensations as the thing that makes life worth living. And then in verse 24, to their vile affections, verse 26, and then to a reprobate mind again in verse 28. That's tragic. And when I think of Australians in that situation, it breaks your heart, doesn't it? But John Murray explains this act of God as the righteous judge. This is what John Murray said about what God does in response to man's sin. His abandonment of the persons concerned to more intensified, aggravated cultivation of their lusts, the lust of their own hearts, with the result that they reap for themselves in this life a correspondingly greater toll of retributive judgment. So they go from bad to worse, and the guilt heaps up around them. And Paul lists the ethical evils. Now, young people, children, what I mean by ethical evils? When we talk about ethics, we're talking about those things that are right and wrong, the things that are moral and immoral, the things you do that will either have good outcomes and bring good effects, or the things you do that will bring bad outcomes, evil effects. So ethics. Paul lists the ethical evils that flow from this threefold exchange into the lives of human beings. And you must not miss the fact that although he focuses in on homosexuality, and we'll get to that in a minute, the ethical evils that flow from this abandonment of God and being given over to the lust of the heart are listed in verses 29 through 31, and really right down through 32. And if you look at that list, it's a list that covers almost everything to do with human depravity and the ruination of people's lives and relationships, and you see it all happening around us in our Australian society today. I won't read them again. But don't miss the fact that there's a list there. And so we must not simply focus on homosexuality as a result of paganism, but these evils that flow into society come from the same root. But why does this denial of God then terminate in homosexuality? Because that's what Paul's saying. God gives them over to a reprobate mind, and they, in their abandonment to sin and the lust of their own heart, they they head into homosexuality. Why? Well, here's the key point, and it applies in all the areas. It is because the rejection of the creator-creature distinction is a denial also of the created order for humanity at the most basic level. And that is the level of human sexuality. When God created us, and he did, it was with this distinction built in. Male and female, he created them. That is fundamental to our humanity in relation not only to one another, but to our Creator. But in a oneist pagan world, the distinctions are an aberration. They don't belong there. How did they get there? Well, to the pagan, the modern pagan, he says, they got there through that guilt religion of Judeo-Christian ethics that said there's a God who speaks, and if you break his law, you're a sinner and you're guilty and you'll be punished. Those distinctions come from that God. He draws the lines, and he doesn't exist. He's gone. So the distinctions are now an aberration. They have to be denied. They've got to be removed. So when it comes to gender and sexuality, what is the ideal? If it's not male and female, what is it? Well, if you read the literature of the modern psychology, the whole literature of our society, the Greens movement and everything else, you'll find that the ideal is androgynous man. Androgynous man. And that's the ideal. Human beings must come to the mature realization that there is neither male nor female. That distinction's a remnant of our guilt religion. We've outgrown it. Homosexuality in an androgynous world is the logical and even the necessary result. It is, in a sense, from the world view of the pagan, homosexuality is the salvation of man. It's the highest expression of his perfect freedom and liberation from the God who draws distinctions. They are free from every distinction whatsoever. And that's why Paul highlights it. Not because it's disgusting and all those things that associate with it, but because of what it represents. Pagan spirituality throws up homosexuality as a kind of sacrament. It's like the outward representation of the spiritual reality of oneism, where there's no distinctions. In their religion, that's as high as you can go. That's why, all down through the ages in pagan cultures, the priests and the priestesses and the shamans have been homosexuals. That might sound a little bit out there to you, so let me just give you a quote from a psychologist and occult spiritualist who was once an advisor to Hillary Clinton when she was in the White House. A woman by the name of June Singer, in her 1977 book, Androgyny, Towards a New Theory of Sexuality, she traced the nature of what she called the androgynous human self, which implies homosexuality, all the way back to the true underlying nature of the cosmos, she said. Now, this is her words. The archetype of androgyny appears in us as an innate sense and witness to the primordial cosmic unity, because you're part of the universe and there's no distinction. Something rises in you. That's what she's saying. That is, she goes on, it is the sacrament of monism or oneism, functioning to erase distinction. And this was nearly totally expunged, she says, by the Judeo-Christian tradition. And now it's back. You all follow that? Somewhat of that? So, mankind, we, step into the consequences inherent in the denial of God. The consequences are visited upon mankind. Mankind has entered into a brave new world in which there is no God. And there's no God-drawn lines between truth and the lie, between right and wrong, between good and evil, between male and female. There are now no timeless ordinances of God to define such things as gender and sexuality and marriage. They're gone. There's no moral law to define right and wrong, and to give structure to what it means to love one another and to love God. It's gone. In this oneest world, man has been given over to all the appetites of his lust-filled heart, is now led by what gives him the greatest pleasurable sensation, or what he calls the greatest good. And where will that lead you? Well, it will lead you always into that list of evils, and ultimately to the free expression of your sexuality in a way that will deny any uncreated restraints or distinctions. So as God's determining good and evil in a material universe with Satan as our mentor, mankind turns itself towards the universe. Where else can he turn? And he worships and serves it. And he works out a new worldview into his pagan spirituality, his ethics, his sexuality, and his art. Because the art is actually the window into it all. Now let's just take, how am I going? Am I way out of time already? I don't even have a watch. My watch broke. When did we start? When have I got to stop? 10 minutes. Not a hug. Let's apply this for a few moments into Australia's context. It took many generations for mankind to work itself into fully fledged paganism. It does not take long for a society to return to the perennial religion. One need but open it up and step into it, or be led into it unthinkingly. And in Australia at the moment, we can see what's described in Romans 1 all around us. You see it in its art, the window to the culture. Now, I've got some things here I've researched that in Australia, so it's in our context. Last year on the ABC News, Adrian Franklin, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Tasmania, gave his assessment of the significance of the 2019 Dark Mofo Festival in Hobart. Most of us would be aware that that's a winter solstice festival. It featured last year the burning of upside-down red crosses, animal sacrifices, and worshippers rolling in the blood of those sacrifices and dancing, mass nude bathing, celebration of homosexuality, and many other ritualistic elements of paganism. It was also funded by the state and federal governments and is viewed as a great boon for tourism and the economy. So we all support it with our taxes. Well, Professor Adrian Franklin, interviewed on the ABC News, said, and I quote, "Art has to ask the difficult questions. It will test the boundaries. There was a time when the Christian church dominated all knowledge and all art, and those days are over," he said. And he's right. And then if you turn from art to ethics, Peter Singer is a case in point. Peter Singer is an Australian professor of bioethics at Princeton University, and he is broadly viewed as being among the world's most influential thinkers. He's also extraordinarily controversial because he's following the principles through. Well, Peter Singer, along with Tasmania's own Bob Brown, co-authored the 1996 Greens Manifesto. And Singer champions the ethic of the new paganism. And he models it on the ethics that were developed by John Stuart Mill 100 years and more back. And let me just quote to you what that ethic is, because you will recognise this from what you hear, not only in the world, but even within the church. This is John Stuart Mill. "The only purpose for which power can be rightly exercised over any member of a civilised community against their will is to prevent the harm to others." And catch that. "His own good, either physical or moral, is not sufficient warrant to restrain him. Over himself and over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign," said John Stuart Mill. Now, Peter Singer takes that up and applies it into our society. And he explains, "We are living in an incredible time of transition. In the West, we've been dominated by a single tradition for 2,000 years. That's Christianity. Now that whole tradition, the whole edifice of Judeo-Christian morality, is terminally ill. And I'm trying to formulate an alternative. Some of what I say seems obscene and evil, if you are still looking at it through the prism of that old morality. That's what happens when morality shifts. People get confused and angry and even disgusted." Well, not surprisingly, the new ethics that he champions argues that nothing that an individual chooses freely to do that doesn't overtly harm others, nothing can be restrained by the law. And that includes, for Singer, suicide, euthanasia, abortion, homosexuality, I hope I don't offend you by saying this, but bestiality, and even the sexual abuse of those who are so severely handicapped that they can't resist. All those things are okay in Peter Singer's world. And that, if you listen carefully, is exactly the ethic that's coming across in all the media. And also, you'll hear it echoed in the attitudes of not only our neighbours, but even some in the church. It's interesting that Peter Singer had a particular bit of advice for us Australians when that whole Israel Folau matter blew up. You remember Rugby Australia sacked him for speaking out on some Christian morality issues. Well, Peter Singer said, rugby union made a mistake. They should have realised that only 14% of Australians say that religion has any importance for them, and not all among them even believe in hell. So most Australians would be more likely to laugh off the Lao's beliefs than to take them seriously. The best way to have reacted would have been to laugh. That's the new ethic. That from the point of view of a new pagan, is just how completely irrelevant what you say to them about God's law really is. Now that's important to realise. Well, what about religion? Well, there is a new spirituality. We've seen the demise of secular humanism on the one hand. It ran its course. We've seen the retreat of Christianity as a major cultural force on the other hand. And now we see the explosion of spirituality. It's not Christian spirituality, but it is spirituality. Now, there's a most notable New Zealander who's been tremendously influential, not only in Australia, but throughout the world. His name is Lloyd Gearing. Lloyd Gearing describes that spirituality. By the way, Lloyd Gearing was a Presbyterian minister who was tried for heresy back in 1967 in New Zealand. And when he could no longer continue in the church, he was snapped up by the Victoria University of Wellington to establish for them a faculty in religious studies. And so he set up for New Zealand pretty much the way they would view their spirituality. Well, Lloyd Gearing sees man as having evolved, so he gathers up the evolutionary vacuum. He sees man as having evolved past the old paradigm of the Creator God and the Trinity of the Bible into a more mature place. We ought to note that, because this new spirituality will pat you on the head as a Christian and say, there, it's okay. We understand. You're still very immature. We've evolved past that to a more mature place. And so he goes on. He sees man outside of the paradigm of the Creator God, outside of the Trinity of the Bible, and now in a new place. He says, we now see and can trust ourselves to the secular Trinity, the one substantial cosmic creativity found in the self-creating universe, the self-evolving humanity, and the emerging global consciousness. That's the Trinity. He says it's not sufficient to acknowledge our dependence on the world. We have to learn to trust it. We've got to put our faith in it. In much the same way our Christian forebears put their faith in a supposed God of heaven, so we must put our trust in this world. Such is the creative present in the self-evolving universe. Oh, it's waffle, isn't it? But if you listen to it, it's got something it's saying. Such is the creative present in the self-evolving universe that it has the potential not only to become alive, but to think. As cosmic energy organized itself into ever more complex patterns, so its potential for consciousness reached ever higher levels, and in the growing self-consciousness of humankind, the universe has become aware of itself. Our minds are the mirror through which the universe sees and understands itself. Now there you have it. That's the new spirituality. And for people like Lloyd Gearing and these people who follow this new spirituality, they've got no problem with Jesus Christ. They've got a reworked Christ concept. Now, says Gearing, this whole new way of understanding reality is today's equivalent of the traditional Christian doctrine of the Incarnation. But now, in an even grander way, we may say the creativity of the cosmos has infleshed itself in the earthly species we call mankind. So you are Christ. And this is the new doctrine of the cosmic Christ. Wow, that is an extraordinary shift. But just briefly, politically and societally, one more quote. One of our politicians, who's a Roman Catholic by the name of Kevin Andrews, has got his finger on the pulse. He's a Liberal member for the House of Representatives in the seat of Menzies. And in 2010, he wrote an article that traces this out from the point of view of politics in Australia. His article was called The Greens' Agenda in Their Own Words. The Greens' Agenda in Their Own Words. And in that article, he writes, "The Green Movement projects the whole planet with a spiritual dimension. The British chemist James Lovelock described the Earth as a complex living organism on which humans are merely parts. He named this planetary organism after the Greek goddess who personified the Earth, Gaia, and described her as alive." That's where that comes from. Well, Singer and Brown, the two early leaders of the Greens, are correct, says Andrews, to describe this as revolutionary. It involves the creation of a new pagan belief system, concerned not with relationship between humans and a creator, but based on a deification of the environment. And that's exactly what we see happening around about us. Andrews said something that really, really struck me. He says, "Unless we understand the ideological foundations of the Greens, we will fail to effectively address the challenge of their revolution. We will be left debating instrumental outcomes as if they are based on the same cultural, philosophical foundations that underpin Western civilization. What the Greens present is the cutting edge of a clash within Western civilization itself." And he's right. They are a manifestation of the new paganism. And look what they've done through that spiritual world and life view in Australia and in Tasmania and in your lives. Well, what hope is there if that's the case? Well, I believe there's reason for wonderful optimism. Wonderful optimism. Some might be inclined to say, this is the apostasy of the last days. There's no possibility of another work of God that reforms the church and so empowers the gospel as to transform the nations. When the Lord comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Few are saved. Close the doors and bar the windows. Prepare for the great tribulation. And pray for the Lord to come quickly. Well, I, brethren, do not believe that's the right response. And I'm not convinced that the biblical data excludes further cycles of reformation and return. But be that as it may, it is very encouraging to realise that Christianity was first planted in pagan Rome. Now that is very, very encouraging. The Christianity that was planted in pagan Rome, beginning with 12 men called by the Lord to preach the gospel, turned the world on its ear. And it's very encouraging to know that, save for some few Jews, what was true in Athens was universally true. Paul saw the city given wholly to idolatry. And Paul's expression of complete confidence in the gospel of Jesus Christ as the power of God unto salvation is made in that very context. And in Romans, Paul gives the pattern built around righteousness for the gospel to be carried out into the pagan world. I haven't got time to look at that. It gives a theological framework of that gospel in those first five chapters of Romans. But there's an underlying biblical truth presupposed in Paul's writing and upon which it's built. It's implied, as I showed you in that first verse, where he calls the gospel of God. It has its context, and it all hangs on that assertion, God is. That's the fundamental premise of what Paul has to say. God is. And God is breaking into our world, which is his, with a message of mercy and hope. That's what's happening. He has come as this God into this world in the flesh. All is not one. That God has come. And he's still breaking into this world. The Creator is one thing, the creation's another. And everything hinges on that. Now I'll jump forward. We say to ourselves, well, Pastor, so what? When this is all said and done, what now? Well, I believe there's a matter of real urgency for the church as we carry out our calling to preach not only to those who are within our own sphere of influence, but to the nation, to our neighbours. And I actually believe that we will be severely judged by God if we hear these things and we're not moved to action. What we've considered, and what we will consider, I trust, in this conference, should help us to see that we cannot assume knowledge in our neighbour. That we must ourselves be prepared to engage with them where they are in their pagan frame of life. You can't assume that they know anything of God. You can't assume they know anything of the God-created distinction. You can't assume that they know anything about what marriage should be. You cannot assume that they know anything about what sexuality should really be. Their conscience might nag at them, but they are blinded in the darkness. We have to be prepared to enlighten them. We need to see and understand the plight of those pagan neighbours. We need to have compassion on them, notwithstanding that they might have had seven failed marriages and be on the eighth, and have a litany of children spread from here to St. Helens and back, of all different names and colours. Because that's what happens in a pagan worldview, you see. That's the sort of life that's produced. We need to understand with compassion that our neighbours who embrace this pagan life view will be involved in those disgusting sins like homosexuality. And they're the ones that are going to be all around us. The only way to engage with that is with understanding and compassion, not with approval, not in any way with condoning, and certainly not with joining, but with understanding and compassion that equips itself to carry the truth to them at the point where they need it. That's what we need. So I believe we should prepare ourselves. Who? Don't look at the pastors only. Certainly the pastors. And certainly the elders. But when I say we, I mean the whole of the membership of the church. Mums and dads and young men, young women, boys and girls. We. We should prepare ourselves. And we should prepare ourselves with clear, convincing, biblical reasoning to be able to bring to our neighbours on these points. We need to meet each person where they are and lead them like Paul does here in Romans and especially in Acts 17 through the evidences to the invisible, eternal, all-powerful, good being who created them and is holding back his judgment and giving men space for repentance to the unknown God who we know and can introduce them to. And then, I believe as a church, we need to provide focused instruction in this whole area. Our membership needs to be equipped, and who will equip them? That equipping would hold back the encroachment of paganism into our own lives, and it would hold it back from the pews and the pulpits. When we think of our children and youth, we need to be able to recognise the encroachments of paganism in all their pervasive subtleties and help our youth see them too. Now that will make a difference. And then I believe in conclusion we need to pray. We need to be praying earnestly, alone, as families, and as a fellowship of saints, yes, in prayer meetings that actually give themselves in those prayer meetings to wrestling with God, not only for ourselves in preparation, but for the right attitude of heart and spirit to engage with not only our neighbours, but ourselves. And we need then to so seek the Lord's blessing that he will actually equip us to be a church for the age. Because let me remind you, if we're still aiming at where we used to be and we've moved, we're going to miss the target. I'm sorry if I've gone too long. I assure you I've left out a whole heap of material. And I've got a whole heap more I'd like to say. But I hope what we've looked at is of benefit to you.